Welcome to Chiropractic Science, where you get to hear interviews with leading chiropractic researchers from around the world. My name is Dr. Dean Smith, and I am the host of Chiropractic Science. I am a clinical professor in the Department of Kinesiology and Health at Miami University, and I'm also a chiropractor in Eaton, Ohio. My research interests relate to understanding how chiropractic affects motor control and human performance. Today, I have the great honor of interviewing Dr. Walter Herzog. But before we get to the interview, I want to thank all of you who have subscribed to Chiropractic Science, and I am especially appreciative to those of you who have contributed five-star reviews on iTunes. iTunes really helps others find out about chiropractic science. So if you like the show, please take a second and write a review. It will support chiropractors everywhere. Please also consider making a contribution to Chiropractic Science to keep these podcasts going. You can do so on our website by making a donation. All right, on to the podcast. And actually, this is my first attempt to do a video podcast. So if everything works out well, I'll have the audio version on the website and through iTunes and the like, and I'll have a special video version of this on YouTube starting out. And if I get good at this, then maybe I'll be able to make video podcasting a part of the thing going forward. So let's see how this works out. But that's what I'm planning for now. So you can check out YouTube to see if there's a video podcast. Anyways, now on to the show. Well, let's get on to the interview with Dr. Walter Herzog. Dr. Walter Herzog did his undergraduate training in physical education at the Federal Technical Institute in Zurich, Switzerland, completed his doctoral research in biomechanics at the University of Iowa in 1985, and completed postdoctoral fellowships in neuroscience and biomechanics in Calgary, Canada in 1987. Currently, he is a professor of biomechanics with appointments in kinesiology, medicine, and engineering, as well as veterinary medicine, and holds the Dr. Benno Nigg Chair in Biomechanics, Mobility, and Longevity. He was the Canada Research Chair for Cellular and Molecular Biomechanics from 2001 to 2022, and the Killam Memorial Chair for Interdisciplinary Research from 2011 to 2021 at the University of Calgary. His research interests are in musculoskeletal biomechanics with emphasis on mechanisms of muscle contraction, focusing on the role of the structural protein titin, and the biomechanics of joints, focusing on mechanisms of onset and progression of osteoarthritis. Dr. Herzog is the recipient of the Borelli Award from the American Society of Biomechanics, the Career Award from the Canadian Society for Biomechanics, the Dyson Award from the International Society of Biomechanics and Sports, the Muybridge Award from the International Society of Biomechanics, and received the Killam Prize in Engineering from the Canada Council for the Arts for his contributions to biomedical research. He is past president of the International, American, and Canadian Societies for Biomechanics. He was inducted into the Royal Society of Canada in 2013. Well, Dr. Herzog, thank you so much for coming on the Chiropractic Science Podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to first just get started with an opener. And normally I have chiropractors on the podcast and I ask them how they get into chiropractic, and we'll get to that point. But since you're in biomechanics, maybe you could just tell the audience how you got into biomechanics in the first place.
Well, when I was an undergraduate student at the Federal Technical Institute in Zurich, I was also a track and field athlete and a track and field coach. And I had the pleasure during that time to work with two national team coaches, one from Switzerland, the team coach for decathlon, and one from Germany, the national team coach for high jump. And they talked a lot about biomechanics. They would say, oh, an athlete needs to do this and this and this because of biomechanics, and needs to do this and this. And they all said, well, what do you mean by biomechanics? And they said, oh, it's the biomechanics. And I'm going, I need to understand this a little bit better. And so So then I decided that I would study biomechanics as a postgraduate degree, and on the master's and PhD level, with the idea that I would be a very sophisticated coach, you know, a coach that would actually know why an athlete needs to jump in a certain way or why an athlete needs to throw the javelin in a certain way. So that really was the motivation, you know, learning about human movement in order to be a better coach. That was really the idea at the beginning.
Wow, that's fascinating. So what kind of questions were you thinking to yourself as you were going through graduate school? Like, if I move a certain way, I'm going to get better performance, or how to prevent injuries, or what were those kind of questions looking like at that time?
Well, since there was really no way to study biomechanics on the graduate level at the time in Switzerland. In fact, there were only either the UK, Germany, or three places in the United States. There were only five places where you could study biomechanics on a, you know, like on a doctoral level. And I decided to go with what I considered was the best and most famous sport biomechanist in the world at the time, Jim Hay, at the University of Iowa. And then there I had the privilege to work with him on track and field project. Jim Hay, my supervisor, got funded for preparing the long jumpers and triple jumpers for the 1984 Olympics. So from about 1980 or early 1981 on, he had funding. And so we would work with people like Jackie Joyner-Kersee and Carl Lewis. I'm not sure if these names mean anything to you, but if you're a track.
They definitely do, yeah.
Aficionado, yeah. Carl Lewis, you know, obviously won the gold medal in the long jump four times in a row, and at the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. He won the 100, 200, 4x100 and the long jump. So I had the privilege to work with these, you know, some of these world-class athletes for some 3.5 years in preparation for the Olympic Games in 1984. And so that really was a dream. And that's really why I decided to go there.
Wow. That's pretty cool. Now, how did you go from Iowa to then Calgary? Was that just sort of what was that progression like?
Well, in about the middle, you know, I was in Iowa with my master's and PhD for a total of 6 years. And in about the middle, so after about 3 years, we actually were talking about the long jump of Carl Lewis. And my supervisor asked me, you know, because Carl Lewis was by far the best long jumper ever, but he did not have the world record. The world record was by Bob Beamon from the 1968 Olympics, not an incredible 8.90 meter jump. And so he said, well, I think Carl Lewis has the muscles and the speed and the body build and everything to jump world record. What can we tell him so he can jump world record? And I remember my answer was something like, after about three years, well, you know, I wonder actually if somebody has the body of a Carl Lewis, how can we optimize how far that person can jump? And I realized very distinctly at that moment that I wasn't really thinking about the athlete anymore. I wasn't the coach anymore, but I was interested in the problem. If you have Carl Lewis's muscles and his body build and his strengths and his speed, how do you optimize a certain thing? In this particular case, the long jump. And that's when I started getting interested in muscles. And so all of a sudden, for my thesis, I did some very theoretical work on predicting individual muscle forces in human movement, sports movements primarily. But it was purely a theoretical construct, kind of an engineering type of, you know, today you would call it an optimization simulation approach that I used. And then I went to Calgary because in Calgary I had the possibility to validate this theoretical approach that I used for my thesis, because there was a person that used preclinical models where he measured multiple muscle forces in the hind limbs of animals, and the electromyographical activities and the electroneurographical activities and a couple of other things. And so then I went very specifically to Calgary because I wanted to learn those experimental techniques where I could validate my theoretical framework.
That is cool to just to hear about the sort of transition and thinking. You're going from the coach to the optimization, but I guess it's still kind of coaching related, because if you can optimize the performance even better, right? So that's pretty cool. I love that transition and in your thinking. So is that basically what you got out of your PhD then? Was, you know, you got to the idea that here's some research that we've conducted, and now we can take that to the optimization level. I'm assuming that was sort of the brainstorm that you had at that point. Does that sound about right?
Yes. Yeah, no, that sounds exactly right. Maybe just a caveat that I realized when I was doing all that mathematical modeling of muscles and the human musculoskeletal system, I realized that I didn't really know very much about muscles. And then in Calgary, working with Andy Hoffer in clinical neuroscience, a muscle neuroscientist and a muscle physiologist, I learned a lot about the mechanical properties of muscles and how they functioned and that type of stuff. And that's exactly what I wanted. And so then I became more and more interested in muscles. And then, you know, it's a kind of a long story, but then I realized measuring the muscle forces, I need to know the muscle properties. Knowing the muscle properties, I really need, in order to understand them, I really need to do measurements on the cell level. Oh no, the cell level is not really good enough. If I really want to understand what's happening, I need to go to single myofibrils and single sarcomeres. And then, oh no, I need to do single actin myosin protein-protein interactions to really understand it. And so, you know, so asking myself, how does it really work 3 or 4 times?
Right.
I ended up from working on human muscles to animal muscles to whole muscles to fibers or cells, and then myofibrils and sarcomeres and single protein-protein interactions. So it was kind of by asking just how does it work a few times, you know, I ended up working a lot on the molecular and cellular level.
Yeah, multiple levels. That sounds typical, doesn't it? You ask one question and then you have 20 more as you start to delve into it. Sounds right, for sure. So now you have just a ton of publications, and maybe you could give me some tips on how you do these. When I looked on PubMed just the other day, you have more than 380 journal publications listed in PubMed, more than 42,000 citations. So with such an incredible career, yeah, I'd like to know, one, maybe how you've done it, and then two, out of all those topics and things that you've explored, is there any one or a couple topics that really stand out in your mind as to, wow, this, I was really able to make a difference in this area?
Yeah, well, how do you do it? That's the first question. I think one advantage that I realized very early on is that I love to write and I like to write. And a lot of scientists do not like to do that. They like to do the research. They like to have the results. They like to ponder the results and go back and forth. But many of my colleagues then seem to get stuck at the writing part. And for me, the writing part was always kind of the ultimate thing. It was kind of the final thing, the thing that I really looked forward in doing. So that, I guess that's one thing that I always was very eager and looked forward to write things up. And then, you know, as I became a little bit more successful with writing grants, I also had a bigger and bigger group. And that really allows you then to be more productive, because then, you know, your students do a lot of the work in the lab, and your students do a lot of the writing as well. And that's really what allowed me, I guess, to do that. I guess the other thing that I always try to emphasize, I think, in our group, we have been fairly successful because I've been able to keep some of my research assistants for essentially my entire life. So there's a person called Tim Leonard who started with me in 1988, and he just retired a couple of months ago. So he was essentially with me my entire career. And then I have another research associate who started with me in 1991. And he's still with me. And then there's a couple of other ones, you know, that have been with me for like some 20 years as I got more money and could hire more people.
Wow.
And so I think, to me, being able to keep highly qualified and good technical people in the lab, that they don't run away or don't get hired away, or, you know, you make their life so attractive in your lab that they want to stay with you. I think that was really one of the big successes, or contributing to the success, that knowledge that we gained throughout the decades stayed in the group. Not like the knowledge was with a student or a postdoc that then left after 4 years, and much of the technical aspect, much of the knowledge, much of whatever, you know, some technical expertise in the lab was then all of a sudden not there anymore. So that, you know, I think that was part of the success as well.
Yeah, that's got to be huge. I mean, just the fact that you've got to know each other that well, right? And know what your strengths are and know what you may or may not want to do, or, you know, that kind of thing, has got to be a huge factor in that. So yeah, absolutely. Well, I do want to get into muscle if you are willing to later, but this is the Chiropractic Science Podcast. So I want to talk about the chiropractic research that you've been involved with. And I just took a look at some of the articles, the top 25 articles in particular that you have had cited. And several of these are chiropractic related articles. So I guess if you could tell us, well, first, how did you get interested in doing any chiropractic related research? Was there somebody that came to you? Or I'm just curious how that connection happened.
Yeah, that's actually a very, you know, I think a very beautiful story, because when I came to Calgary, the Alberta Chiropractors had an organization, kind of like, I forgot now exactly what it was called, but it was essentially a research group. So where there were these about eight people that would meet like once a month and discuss what chiropractic research should be done. And the leader of that group was a chiropractor called Ron Carter. And he was then the man who approached me. And, you know, when I newly came to the University of Calgary, because he knew I was a musculoskeletal biomechanist, was interested in bones, muscles, joints, you know, and so on. And so he approached me and organized some money for me to do research, to do chiropractic research. And there were a couple of really beautiful things about that, because I said, well, I don't know much about chiropractic, but I know it's a profession, and you obviously have a certain, you know, you might have as a clinician a certain bias that this is all good and works and this, that, and that. And I said, so the condition that I have is that whatever I'm finding, I'm allowed to publish. And Ron Carter said, yeah, absolutely no problem. And then the other beautiful thing about it is that then they gave me a little bit money, you know, every year for doing the research. And they do that to this day.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
So one or other chiropractic organization, always organized through the Alberta Chiropractic Association and also through the Canadian Chiropractic Association, they have been my longest supporter, not the biggest supporter in terms of money.
Sure.
But the money from, you know, 1985 when I came to Calgary up to 2025, so that's 4 years, I've gotten a little bit of money every year specifically to do chiropractic research. And the other thing also was, then when I said, so what are you interested in? Then Ron Carter again said, whatever you want to do. But we want to know, you know, about spine biomechanics and maybe as it relates to chiropractic. And but there were really no guidelines. They didn't say, oh, we want you, you know, with that money they're giving you this year, we want you to do that. With this money this year, we want you to do that. So it was very flexible what I wanted to do. And I had the assurance, and that has been upheld, that I could always publish, you know, whatever I found, independent if that might be, you know, reflecting good or bad on the chiropractic profession. And so that was very, very generous. And, you know, and I cannot emphasize enough, you know, the involvement of Ron Carter at the beginning and then throughout my career. He's retired now, but still a couple of times a year, we meet up for lunch and just have a philosophical talk about how things are going. So that's been a beautiful relationship that went all the way back to the very beginning when I came to Calgary.
Wow, that's really cool to hear that. I wondered if something like that had existed, but you know, I know a lot of people are going to be interested in just hearing about that relationship, because there's a lot of emphasis now of chiropractors, of course, trying to get into universities, doing their PhDs. Of course, at Pittsburgh now, they have a program, a chiropractic program. So there's a lot of interest in integrating chiropractic into these, you know, top tier programs. And so happy to hear, you know, how that came about and just the relationships that you've been able to build. And I know there have been a ton of chiropractors that have either done master's or PhDs, either with you directly or in conjunction with you, maybe, or doing their training elsewhere, but you're on the team, and the article. So, that's also, I mean, that just takes so much time to mentor and be a part, of that. And I certainly know what that's like. So, but, I wanted to concentrate on the way I see it, three, broad categories or topics within chiropractic that you've approached, and feel free to make any corrections to this as you deem fit. But one of them is certainly on the forces that are exerted during spinal manipulation. That seems like a natural for sure for what your research gets into. Another one, always a hot topic in this, is spinal manipulation and the biomechanics of the vertebral artery, as well as the carotid artery. We'll put that in there as well. And then neurophysiology and mechanical effects of the manipulation itself. So whether it be on EMG, you know, muscle again, or whether it be on the way that joints move and that sort of thing. So those are the three broad topics. And I'd just like to dive in if we could. And we'll start with the forces that are exerted during spinal manipulation. I figure we could start with this one, try to answer some sort of conceptual questions before we get into the biomechanics of the vertebral artery, which is, you know, one of the main topics as well. But I'd say there, one of the papers that had a lot of citations to it was simply called The Biomechanics of Spinal Manipulation. And that was published in 2010. And I think in many ways, that's still sort of the go-to article. And it just talks a lot. I mean, it's a broad overview. And then you get into specifics of how the biomechanics play out and how it even interacts with the neurophysiology. So I'd just like to ask you, if you could, just give us an overview as you see it of the effects, the biomechanical effects of spinal manipulation, and just start or just free form, whatever you think is best. I just want to get a feeling of how you think of the problem and what you think is going on from your point of view.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because when I came to Calgary and then got involved with the chiropractors, you know, first thing that I did is that I visited some of the chiropractic colleges, you know, CMCC in Canada, and then three or four different chiropractic colleges in the United States as well, to just see what the philosophy was and then, you know, how manipulation was taught and how it was done, and really get the feeling. And then I went to some local chiropractors, to their clinics, to see what are they actually doing. And I realized this is a physical and manual. Well, the primary aspect to me, at least, and you know, I might be corrected here by a clinician, but the primary aspect to me, there was a hands-on touching force application, you know, on various parts of the spine or the parts of the body. And so I started asking people, so how are you taught doing that? And you know, how do you validate that? How much force are you supposed to apply, and how do you do that? And then I was very surprised that really nobody could give me an answer, because I asked him, so if you say in terms of body weight, you know, how much force do you apply in a certain manipulation. You know, is it like 10% of body weight? Is it 50%? Is it 200%? You know, yeah, I heard all kinds of different answers, but nobody really knew. And so that's how it came about that with Brett Hessel at the time in the early, late 1980s, early 1990s, we started, you know, getting instrumentation so that we could measure directly the forces that chiropractors were exerting on different parts of the spine. And we focused on the spine. And then if I think back, you know, and also, you know, up to 2010, that particular article that you mentioned, the thing that always struck me is that obviously the chiropractic manipulations, the force that are applied, depend very much where in the body it is. And all chiropractors that we have ever measured, and there's approximately 80 individuals that we have measured over the many years. And cervical spinal manipulation always have the least force. And then thoracic and lumbar and sacroiliac joint manipulations have more force. And some people apply more to thoracic, some more to sacroiliac joint or the lumbar spine or vice versa. But there, on average, I would argue that the forces are comparable. And again, if you talk about on average, they're about four times higher than in the cervical spine. But the other thing that I also realized is that chiropractors give very different amounts of force. What one chiropractor's preload force might be could be the peak force during the manipulation of another chiropractor.
Wow.
And we have measured peak spinal manipulative forces on the thoracic or the lumbar spine as low as 200, 250 newtons and as high as 1200 newtons. So like a factor of 5 or 6. And it also became apparent when we did multiple measurements on different patients, there tended to be a very strong trend that those, especially those that were very heavy adjusters, they were heavy adjusters, and meaning, you know, transmitting a lot of force on all the patients. And those that were very, what I would call soft adjusters, they seemed to be soft with all the patients. And it was very interesting because when we then asked the patients, you know, they also seemed to attract a different clientele. I think that the heavy force application chiropractors, they seemed to attract people that really wanted to feel the manipulation, whereas the very, very soft ones seem to be attracting more people that, you know, that might even be a little bit worried about the force and what's going to happen. And they enjoyed that it was small. But basically, really, what I always try to say is how much force is applied depends on where on the spine the application is made. And different chiropractors will use very, very distinctly different forces. The one thing in, a high velocity, small magnitude type of application, the one thing that seems to be relatively constant is the timing of the impulse, you know, the time duration of the impulsive thrust. That, you know, that always seems to hover on the cervical spine around 100 milliseconds, and on the thoracic and lumbar spine always seems to hover around, you know, 150 milliseconds, you know, on average. And there's not much discrepancy. There's not the 4 or 5 times discrepancy or 6 times discrepancy like in the force application.
Huh.
So like we have never had anybody apply a manipulation in, rather than 150 milliseconds, applied in 600 or 700 milliseconds.
Right.
Not when we ask for a chiropractic, you know, high velocity, small magnitude type of a manipulation. So that's kind of the gist of that, you know, kind of the summary.
Yeah, yeah.
How I would summarize that.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. So I'll just follow up with maybe a couple questions then. Since there's such broad variation in the forces, but there's a relatively common, we'll say, thrust interval, do you think... I've always thought of it more as the force application, but do you think there is something inherently unique about the quickness of the thrust maybe that could explain some of the findings? And I don't know if that is something that you've even, you know, looked at necessarily, but I just throw it out there since it seems to be something that's pretty common.
Yeah, we have looked at it in a couple of contexts. So for example, one context was that there was a theory put out by a chiropractic group out of CMCC, and they argued that you needed to, invoke a joint crack. You need to, you needed to invoke that cracking sound.
Yeah.
Because that was essential for the spinal manipulation, and also otherwise you would not get the physiologic response, muscle spindle response that you then could measure as an EMG. And so we did a study where we had chiropractors, perform spinal manipulations the normal way. And then we also asked them to try to apply the force at the same place, in the same direction, but very slowly, increase the force very, very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened there is sometimes when a chiropractor gave a spinal manipulation, they would not get the crack, but they still would get an EMG response.
Hmm.
And when they got a crack and did it fast, they always got an EMG response as well. But if they did it fast, even if they didn't crack, the EMG response was still there. If they then did what they normally don't do, that they apply the force in the same direction and very, very slowly, and I'm talking about, over 3 to 5 seconds, until they potentially would get a crack, and on various occasions with that slow application, they would also get a crack, but there was no EMG signal.
Ooh, that's interesting.
So the idea that the EMG signal was required, that the crack was required to produce the EMG, was kind of defeated in that particular study. But you got the reflex response if you did the manipulation fast. If you did it slow, even if you got the crack, there was no response. So if you think that, an electromyographical spindle type reflex response is a desired aspect of a chiropractic manipulation, then you have to do it fast. Otherwise, you're not going to get it.
Got it. That's fascinating. I do recall reading that study. So thanks for bringing that up. I forgot about it at the moment. So some of your previous work has found that adjustments, there's substantial relative movement. I'm just quoting it now. Substantial relative movement of the target vertebra and adjacent vertebrae during the preload phase. And there was further relative movement of the target and adjacent vertebra during the thrust phase. I'm pointing this out because there's debate in our literature whether you can be very specific on target vertebra in terms of the mechanics of it, and then I guess adjacently whether that matters in any clinical context. How specific you are. It seems like the latest literature is suggesting that it doesn't really matter how specific you are, but I have to imagine at some level, the biomechanics do matter. Like you can't thrust, for example, at the hand and expect to achieve some sort of mechanical effect at the lower back. I'll just put it that way. So I'm just curious what your thoughts on that sort of overall discussion about specificity and from a mechanical standpoint, and then what your thought is on just an overall clinical standpoint.
Standpoint, it's a tricky one because, yeah. As you know, I'm not a clinician, so
sure.
So I'm kind of putting that to the end and might not answer it. But what I can answer is, when we did measurements of relative movements these were mostly done. The most data that we have there is on thoracic spinal manipulation, where we did a straight anterior to posterior to anterior thrust on a transverse process of one or the other thoracic spine. And as you mentioned, I should qualify this because this was done in cadaveric specimens, because in order to be super, super accurate, we put in bone pins into, several of the target vertebra, and then also, I think, two up and two down as well. So there were about five vertebral bodies that had these bone pins in there, where we then could very, very accurately, I mean, within a fraction of a millimeter and a fraction of a degree, could measure the movement of the vertebra when a chiropractor did these manipulations. And what we found is exactly what you said. When you give a preload force, the whole of the spine deformed. It was not only that the one vertebral body moved and everything else stayed in place, but everything deformed.
Got it.
And then the interesting thing was, because the idea was, are we getting into a paraphysiological space? And I'm not quite sure what that actually means. But what we did is then we had the chiropractor after they had applied the preload force. We had them perform a thrust. And what we saw there when the thrust came, the whole spine further deformed as the forces got higher and higher. So the two vertebral bodies below and above the targeted vertebrae, they would also move down with the movement. But we saw a very distinct, when we then looked at the target and the next one, then typically at the peak of the thrust, we saw a very distinct, usually about 1.5 to 2 degrees rotation. And 1 to 1.5 millimeter displacement that was there, and that was significantly bigger than you would see, let's say, from the vertebra next to the target and then to the next one. So we clearly got a bigger rotation and a bigger relative movement of the target vertebra relative to the adjacent vertebra on top and bottom compared to the adjacent ones relative to the next one.
Got it.
And so we felt there was a specificity there in the sense that you clearly evoke more movements between what you target and then the nearest neighbor.
Okay. Now, so that just made me think of a question, because I know you've done EMG research. Were you able in any way, well, this was done on cadaver, so are there any studies that you've done in living individuals where you try to target a vertebra and then look at the EMG response and how close to the target? Just curious about that.
We did that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, we did that. So in live subjects, and I think that's published somewhere, a couple of publications in spine.
Okay.
Where we put, if I remember correctly, it was 16 EMG recording electrodes. And I should say doublet recording electrodes on the back, and then also on the deltoid, on the gluteal muscles.
Okay.
So the person was laying there, and again we did a variety of different manipulations on the neck, on the thoracic spine, and on the sacroiliac joint and lumbar spine, and we essentially measured what electromyographical reflex responses we would see. So reflex responses that would occur within a very short time, within 150 or so milliseconds of the force application. And again, that was very interesting in a variety of senses. So for example, when you gave manipulations on the cervical spine or the thoracic spine or the lumbar spine, the areas of muscles, the muscles up and down the spine and into the arms and legs that were activated and showed an EMG reflex signal, that changed. It was like a map. You push somewhere, quickly gave an application, and you would get a whole area of EMG responses. And the interesting thing I also found was that very often you get a response in the deltoid muscles and in the gluteal muscles that are not really kind of part of your back. But it's, to me, that suggested that at least from a physiological point of view, you affect not only the target vertebrae, but on the other hand, when you give a manipulation, we always found an EMG reflex response at the target area, and then more or less in neighboring areas as well. But that depended exactly on what manipulation it was and where it was given. But that was clearly the case. We did that study also in using the activator method at the time. There was in Canada, at least, there was some controversy about the using the activator. And for a while, I'm not sure if that's still the case, for a while, in one of our provinces in Saskatchewan, the use of the activator was kind of not allowed by a chiropractor in clinical practice.
Huh.
And so we tested what does actually an activator do. And when you use the activator instrument, then it also gave an EMG reflex response, but only exactly at the target site. There was no spreading of the EMG response to anywhere else.
Huh.
So you could say that's good because you're very specific, or you could say, oh, wow, you know, it's bad because, you know, if you get all these reflex responses all over the body, that might potentially be interesting and good.
Yeah.
That's kind of the work we did on the EMG side.
Yeah, and just hearing you talk, I'm thinking to myself, okay, a reflex is probably about 150 to maybe 180 milliseconds, something like that for a simple reflex. Maybe that's part of what that quick thrust is helping out with. So then if you spread that out, you're not going to get that response, regardless of whether you get the crack, like what you're saying.
And it's interesting, of course, you know, we were a bit careful about talking about reflex responses and trying to associate them with, we thought they're likely spindle reflexes, but of course it's really hard because during a spinal manipulation, you don't really know, let's say if it's a spindle reflex, you don't really know exactly when during the manipulation the trigger is given. And since the manipulation takes 150 milliseconds, you know, is it given right at the beginning, the first 10 milliseconds?
Right.
Or is it given a little bit later? And then you also get not only just a one single motor unit action potential, compound motor unit action potential, but you get a signal that looks like a short EMG signal, a short burst of 100 or 150 milliseconds. Whereas that's actually the other difference. When you do it with an activator, you get that beautiful compound motor unit action potential.
Mm.
Once, that's it.
That's it. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Wow. That is fascinating. One last question before we move on to the next topic. And that is, and I was really intrigued in this 2010 article on review of spinal biomechanics, spinal manipulation, was you made a comment essentially, what we don't know as much about is, okay, we're imparting this force into the spine and SI joints as well. We don't know what's happening internally to the forces. And I was really intrigued and just, I'm not exactly sure what you meant by that. I could probably hypothesize, but I just love to hear in your own words, what were you thinking about at that point? What are you talking about?
What I was thinking about is, you know, when I talk to clinicians and they come to the lab and we do a study and then they tell me, okay, I'm going to do, let me use the example again of the thoracic spine. I'm going to give a manipulation on the transverse process and the left transverse process of T3, T5, whatever. And then I said, well, how accurate do you think you are in hitting that transverse process? And they said, oh, you know, I feel it, you know, I'm good. But then what we started doing measurements, we didn't only measure the forces, but we also measured the contact areas. And what happens, of course, you know, since your hand is soft and the patient has a soft back as well, when you then push two soft surfaces against one another, the contact area gets bigger and bigger, the bigger the forces. And so therefore, when we then measure, 400 newtons, of force is transmitted, then that's the force summed over the entire area. And if you then just looked at the one transducer that is right situated above the transverse process, you might only have measured 5 or 10 newtons. So a very small amount of the force is then actually directly, you know, where you want it to be. And so the argument then was, well, where does all that force go? You know, is it taken up by ligaments and muscles and bones and this and that?
For sure.
So we wanted to know a little bit about that. And then, of course, later on, when we talk about, the vertebral artery and, you know, then people have also asked about, you know, herniations, you know, then the question becomes, well, how much force goes to a vertebral artery, how much force goes to a vertebral disc. Are we endangering people here on causing injuries potentially, and so therefore, the interest, and to my shame, and I guess to my biomechanics profession shame, we know very, 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 very little about where the forces go. There's a little bit work that has been done in cadaveric specimens on pressure changes in intervertebral disc during manipulation. And then, of course, there is our work on the vertebral artery and the intercarotid artery. But what are the forces on the ribs? What are the forces on the muscle? What are the forces potentially on ligaments that connect vertebral bodies? Nobody seems to ever have really tried to look at that very carefully.
That's fascinating. Now, do you think that would hold true of something as mundane as just exercising? I mean, do we know that kind of explicit information about just how bending your knee during a certain exercise affects the ligaments and the joints to the level that you'd like to know for the biomechanics of spinal manipulation?
Very, very little. There is, for example, you talked about ligaments. There's a colleague of mine in Vermont, and he has many, many, many years ago, this must be 25 years ago, he implanted a force transducer into an anterior cruciate ligament of patients that underwent open knee surgery and did a couple of muscle contractions and did a couple of passive movements. And got a little bit of an idea. But if you ask me during running or so, have you ever measured anything like that? No, there's nothing there. What people did much more so, again, 15, 20 years ago, is that they started to instrument with force transducers prosthetic devices. So when somebody needed a new hip joint or a new knee joint, they would instrument that with force transducers, and then you get the bone-to-bone contact forces.
Yeah, that's clever.
Not really the ligamentous forces, not really the muscular forces, not really anything like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's just fascinating. All right, well, thanks for all that. That's just awesome. Well, let's get into the next topic, which you alluded to in trying to figure out where all these forces go, and that is the topic of spinal manipulation and the biomechanics of the vertebral and internal carotid arteries. And this is where you've done a lot of investigation. I know chiropractors are going to be very interested to hear your discussions here. You gave an idea of how you got into chiropractic research in particular. How did you get into this particular topic? How did it come to you? Was there a particular case that came about and people just wanted to know what the deal was and there wasn't really any research out there? Or how did you get into this one?
It was a chiropractic master's degree student, and his name is Bruce Simons. He's from Calgary. He's still doing chiropractic work. And so he was my master's degree student, and he said, I would like to look at that. I would like to look at the stresses and strains in the vertebral artery, because, I think this is going to be very important, because there appear to be, and this is like 1998, 1999, there appear to be these accusations that maybe, chiropractic manipulation might be causing strokes. And I said, sure, but then we looked around and I said, well, if you want to do this very, very accurately, we can't do this in humans. I cannot put a strain gauge on a vertebral artery of a live human being. There's absolutely no way anybody would ever allow me that, at least not in Canada. And so then we decided, well, let's do this in cadaveric specimens. And we were not really worried about, because, muscles and ligaments and vertebral arteries, they are connected to bony segments in a certain way, and if you're alive or dead, that doesn't really change. My muscles or my vertebral artery doesn't all of a sudden insert somewhere else,
right?
Because you're dead. So we thought, oh, if you have fresh cadavers, and that should work really well. And so, and then we were doing that work for about a year, And then there was a case in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, where a woman, and I think that was in 1999, where a woman died on a chiropractic table, presumably because of a tear of the vertebral artery, and I guess was dead within a minute. And then I guess reporters and TV and so were looking around. Does anybody have data? And then I guess somebody pointed them to us, and like within a day or two, we had, you know, all the major local and national TV stations and radio and television and journals and magazines.
Sure.
In our laboratory, kind of trying to see what we are doing. And we knew very, very little about that. And then I said, well, this obviously seems to, this obviously seems to be of interest to the public, and this seems to be of interest to the chiropractic profession. And then we continued doing that. And then I think it was in 2002 or 2003 where there was then this big first case, I think, in Canada, Lena Lewis.
Yes.
Where I was then an expert witness. The claim was that there was a stroke. I forgot now the exact details, but, you know, maybe about 2 weeks after the chiropractic manipulation, but the stroke was initiated and caused uniquely by the chiropractic manipulation. And the interesting thing was the way they argued was that the vertebral artery during the manipulation would be stretched too much, and that would cause, that would cause a dissection of the vertebral artery and then cause a thrombus, and then that would dislodge and
sure.
cause a stroke. So the idea was the vertebral artery is stretched too much, and therefore this all happened. And at that time, we then had the full data from Bruce Simons. And the interesting thing was that we found that the vertebral artery, the way it is in your, goes along your neck, it's actually slack.
Hmm.
It's slack. And therefore, when you move your head, we found that approximately when you go through the full range of motion, that's when you get to the point where the slack is taken up. So right now, my vertebral artery, for all I know, for whatever you have measured, is slack. And now if I do something like that, turn really hard, then maybe my one vertebral artery might be just at the point where it's not slack anymore. It's not stretched yet.
Right.
And so then we did these measurements of range of motion, lateral and rotation and flexion, extension, and everything that you could think of, the full range of motion. And then we looked at, how much of this slack would be taken up. And then we would see how much of this slack was taken up by a chiropractic manipulation. And by that time, I understand from older chiropractors that was not always the case. But at that time, a chiropractic manipulation was done in some kind of an intermediate head position, maybe slightly tilted, maybe slightly extended.
Right.
But it was not done at the very
at full range,
of the active
sure.
passive range of motion, which I understand in the old days might have been done. But so we measured that, the way modern chiropractors, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, used to do that. And the fact simply was that the elongations and the slack that was taken up by the vertebral artery during a spinal manipulation was much smaller than what you really could do by just, going through the range of motion that you naturally have. And so therefore, we argued there is absolutely no way how a chiropractic manipulation could overstretch a vertebral or a carotid artery, same for the carotid artery, could overstretch a vertebral artery and therefore cause it to be stretched and therefore cause a dissection and therefore cause all the things that people had argued. And it was really interesting because I was at the Lena Lewis case, I think it was 3 full days that I was interrogated.
Wow.
And when we showed all that evidence that, it's just not stretched, I'm really sorry, but it's not stretched.
Right.
Then they started arguing differently. Then they started arguing, well, you know, but maybe it's the pressure. Maybe you know, you have the vertebral artery there, and maybe when you press on it. And I must say, I wasn't really prepared for that. But my immediate answer was, well, I don't think that would really be a problem, because first of all, the vertebral artery is in there, and it's very, very hard to imagine that you could actually compress it. But even if you could, and when we take blood pressure measurements, I mean, we do that with our brachial artery all the time, you know?
Right.
Blood pressure measurement, you know, we occlude the flow for 10 seconds or 15 or 20 seconds, and that never, ever seemed to cause a dissection of the artery, as far as we can tell. We've never heard of it. So,
yeah.
So the argument, so that was then the argument. But of course, you know, in a court, it's really interesting. In a court, science doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah, yeah.
Charisma seems to matter. And how well you can explain to a jury, if there's a jury there, how well you can explain to a jury what the science actually means. And, you know, I find that a very interesting, but also at the same time, a little bit of frustrating process. And so I've been involved in multiple cases as an expert witness, but I've tried to give those cases away to my colleagues if I can, except if somebody says, we really need you here, this is going to be a very important case. And so every year I have maybe one or two cases, but I probably get asked, you know, more than that.
Wow. Well, it's interesting you're talking about the, you know, being a scientist in the courtroom, because I asked J. David Cassidy the same, and I think you might have a few publications with him. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm misspeaking, but I asked him about the same issue, and he said basically something to the effect of, well, I prefer to talk science and not medical legal sort of jargon, because science is what I know, and this is what we know from a scientific perspective. And I thought that was a very, you know, eloquent, you know, clear thinking way to describe the situation.
It was interesting. Sorry for going back.
Yeah, no,
the
please.
The Lewis case was the first chiropractic case where I was ever in a courtroom. And the first day, the only questions that were asked to me, and, you know, just for people who might want to think about, you know, being a legal expert, the first day, so like for 6 hours, 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the afternoon, I was just asked about my CV.
Oh my gosh.
No question about my work or anything. It was just questions about my CV.
Huh.
And you know, and essentially this the idea to taint my reputation, you know, to essentially paint me as not trustworthy. And, you know, that's something, if you do that, that is something that you need to be prepared for.
Yeah. Wow.
People will completely try to discredit. And the other thing that I found very frustrating is that they will critique really hard every single detail of peer-reviewed scientific publications, but then they will throw things out there without any foundation. Oh, we know, we have known for a long time that chiropractic manipulation causes stroke. I mean, everybody knows that. And then you go, well, how do you know that?
Right, right.
And, you know, and so I find it so interesting how there seem to be two measures. You know, one is against the opposing party, where you are hypercritical. Every single detail is looked at very carefully and critiqued normally negatively.
Yeah.
Whereas then the other side will make these sweeping statements that have absolutely no basis.
You know, yeah.
No scientific basis, you know, and that's something one needs to get used to as well, because in a scientific context, you know, when I'm at a conference and I get asked questions at the end of a talk, or when I get questions, you know, from reviewers of a paper, I can respond, and there is, you know, mostly, not always, but, you know, 19 out of 20 times, there is a respectful, constructive dialogue going on, but that's not happening in the court. There's no respect. There's no construction.
Yeah, it's almost like they conflate the possibility of something, like the plausibility, we'll say, from a scientific perspective, and they equate that to the reality. But then you have the data, so it's like, you know, they're trying to use their biological plausibility, just like, well, if I put a force in there, that should do something to the artery, right? But no, we measured something different. It's just fascinating. Yeah, and the articles about Slack, those were the ones with Dr. Gorrell, is that right? The Lindsay Gorrell, she did the Slack.
Essentially, everybody, you know, there were several students and postdocs in my lab. And the most recent one was a chiropractor from Brazil, Carolina van Gundes, and she found it. And Lindsay Gorrell found that. But really, the first person to really describe that was Bruce Simons in the very first article that we wrote. And then Sarah Wuss later on did that as well. And then I did an independent study where I did all the work and found that as well. So we have found that, you know, with like five, you know, with different cadavers and with, I think it's now five different groups of people doing it, but always in my lab. And if I can make a plug here on your podcast.
Yeah, please.
One of the criticisms that we always have is that they say, Dr. Herzog, of course, you'll always find the same way. And nobody has ever been able to verify that or has verified it. And so if there's a biomechanist out there, it would be fabulous if one or two other laboratories would try to do the same studies as us and just see if they get the same results in a completely different setting with different students and independent of us. And, you know, we think they would find the same results. You know, we don't think we have ever, if we were very careful, we've done this carefully. But it would be good if the work was redone and independent laboratories would find the same result. Or if not, then, you know, we need to know that as well.
Sure. One more question about the Slack. So that Slack that you found was consistently in cadavers. Do we know how much Slack? Is there even more Slack in a living individual? Do we know what that? I'm assuming with ultrasound or something, you'd be able to like see some sliding or movement. I don't know. I'm not a radiologist, but I have to assume that we could probably verify that somehow.
I think that possibly with some high resolution ultrasound imaging, that might be possible to see. The way we define slack is, you can define slack, you know, when you see, you know, that it's wiggly or so. But also the way we define slack is that after we are done with our experiments, we take the vertebral arteries out, the whole vertebral artery, and we put it into a materials testing machine. And we keep our strain measurement devices that we have, we keep them on the vertebral artery. And then we stretch the vertebral artery in the materials testing machine and we check when do we see first force. So force is 0000000. We stretch. And then all of a sudden the force is not zero anymore. It's a very teeny tiny force there. And that's what we call the slack length, because that is when now you want to go beyond that length, then you need to apply force.
Got it.
And sometimes, you know, an artery that's in there might be looking relatively straight, but the problem is not only that it might look straight, but there is slack at the attachments. I'm not sure how many of your listeners have ever looked very, very carefully at a vertebral artery. But, you know, it's attached, you know, inside the foramina there, and it's attached with a little connective tissue. And that connective tissue gives, so it's not fixed to the bone. It's fixed to connective tissue, and that connective tissue can wiggle. And for a long time, we tried to actually quantify that systematically, but we've never done it. But, you know, just by eye, there seems to be at the proximal antedistal end, there appears to be about a millimeter or two of wiggle, so that when the vertebral artery is attached here, you know, with this ligament, you know, that ligament can go back and forth. And so you can move the vertebral artery without making it longer, because the attachment of the vertebral artery to the foramina has wiggle. It has a millimeter or so of wiggle.
Yeah, it's interesting. Presumably that would have some sort of protective properties, right? Like it, I mean, the neck should move, it's mobile, right? So
yeah,
okay, Okay. Well, that's great. Let's get on to the last topic relating to chiropractic. And then if we have time, you're being very generous. So, but if we have time, we can maybe talk about the sarcomere a little bit. So the last topic is just the effects of manipulation on posture, gait, and maybe some of the neurophysiology. But I feel like we've already talked a good amount about some of the EMG findings. So maybe we can concentrate on posture and gait. And the mechanical effects, seems like most of the work has been done on sacroiliac joints, but maybe we can talk about lumbar spine if you've done some of that as well. So yeah, if you just sort of give us an overview about this problem or this topic area.
Yeah, so more at the beginning of my career in Calgary, I didn't have all the stuff available, like pressure devices to measure things, and I didn't have sonic micrometry, strain gauging available for doing vertebral artery measurements and so. So at the beginning, but we had a gait laboratory, you know, a walking laboratory. And so one of the early studies was that we had, a bunch of patients come in the evening and they were treated by their normal chiropractor, except they were treated in the laboratory rather than the clinic. And, you know, some of the chiropractors volunteered to do that. So we were then interested in measuring gait asymmetries in that first study of people that had a sacroiliac joint syndrome, the idea being that somehow the sacroiliac joint might have gotten stuck somehow, might not be quite as mobile anymore. You as clinicians know better what that means when you treat the sacroiliac joint. But anyway, so we then measured people, doing different types of walking over the platform before the manipulation and after the manipulation. And then they came back multiple times. If I remember correctly, we did about 3 times per week, and I think
oh, wow.
2 weeks or so. Yeah. And it was very interesting and initially very perturbing. And the reason why it was a little bit, I was a little bit deflated when we saw the first results after the first set of experiments, because what happened is the people were asymmetric, like people are before, but then we gave them the chiropractic manipulation, and I thought, oh, now we got rid of a problem, we got rid of some lack of movement in the sacroiliac joint or did something else, and therefore they would be more symmetrical. But very, 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 very consistently after the chiropractic manipulation, they were less symmetrical. And I'm going, what's happening here?
Yeah,
Chiropractic manipulation messes it all up. but then that was the interesting thing, because we had them come, as I said, I think 6 times over a 2 week period. But then the interesting thing was when they came back the second time, the third time, the fourth time, and so on, they were more and more symmetrical than they were the first time.
Wow.
So the way I thought about it is, that the chiropractic, if you think purely about symmetry, the chiropractic manipulation acutely, 5 minutes after the manipulation, it messes up your symmetry. But over a couple of days, when you come back, your symmetry is better. And then it messes it up again, and then it's better. And then it messes it up again, and when you come back, it's better.
Yeah.
So the long-term effect seemed to be that symmetry was established and was much better than when they initially came in with the complaint. But if you just measured it once, then you would see that the asymmetry got bigger. You would go, what's happening here?
Yeah.
But then one of the chiropractors that helped us there, he said that for him that was not really so surprising. The idea that you give a manipulation and then people are a little bit out of whack and something has happened to their bodies and they cannot really, and then don't really immediately adjust for that, account for that. He felt that there was a perturbation there. He felt that he actually, almost expected that. And then when they came back later on and they were better then, that was the icing on the cake.
Yeah. My research is kind of motor control, postural control related. And so when I think of that, I think, oh, maybe, it's just something that, they have to adapt to, almost like exercise and the immune system. For example, if you do an acute bout, it's going to suppress your immune system, at least acutely. Yep. But as you continue chronically, you know, doing exercise, you get the benefits that we all sort of come to expect with it. I wonder if something like that is going on. And of course, people who may have asymmetries to begin with may have learned a compensation pattern that, you know, they've adapted their nervous system to be able to move in a certain way. And so it may take a little bit of time. It probably is not going to be a very acute thing to make everything symmetrical. At least that's the way I'm kind of thinking of it at this point.
And that's essentially how we then discussed the results. And, you know, that kind of was the consensus among the clinicians and us, you know, that's how we wrote it up essentially.
Awesome. Well, do we have time to, can I ask you about the muscle, your studies on muscle?
You can, but that might be really boring for clinicians.
I don't think so. I think they'll be very fascinated. Maybe we can stick with the sarcomere and your work on Titan specifically. And I was teaching my functional anatomy undergraduate class today, and we were talking about Titan. So this plays in very, very nicely, I think, to that. But it, as you said, now I have a much better understanding. So you started, you know, at Iowa, and you're trying to figure out some of the properties of how people's performance improves. And then you realize, I got to go down to this level and then this level. And then ultimately, you're looking at the sarcomere level and within the sarcomere. And so how did this Titan come about? How long have we even known about Titan? And then what has your research contributed to that?
Well, Titan was discovered in 1976 and then was called Connectin initially there, and then by Maruyama and then Wang in 1979 rediscovered it and called it Titan. And the way I came onto Titan was because, as I said, you know, I started then doing single fiber experiments and the muscles have these different properties. One is called the force length relationship. One is called the force velocity relationship. And they are very nicely explained by Huxley's 1957 crossbridge theory and this actin and myosin interaction and crossbridges. Beautifully explained. But then at one point, you know, when I read the literature and did things, I came across, you know, these history dependent effects, residual force enhancement and residual force depression. And these two properties, even though they had been known and well described, at least since the early 1950s, they were never really incorporated into the mechanism, the molecular mechanism of muscle contraction. And they couldn't really be explained with actin myosin and the way Huxley's model worked. And so I was very interested in doing work on history dependence, because I thought if I can figure out how that works, I might learn more about the molecular mechanism of muscle contraction. And then we got super, super lucky because in about 2000, we did these experiments on soleus muscle in an animal model, on soleus muscle. And we did these force enhancement experiments where we stretched an active muscle to a longer length. And then we looked at the force enhancement that you get, the residual force enhancement. And then we deactivated the muscle and we realized that the passive force stayed elevated. And then initially we thought, did we damage the muscle? Did we do something wrong or so? But then we just let the muscle relax, went to a shorter length, and we started the experiment again. And the muscle had lost all that passive force. We did it again. And we always found this additional force after an active stretch that was not there when you just isometrically activated the muscle or passively stretched it. And so I figured there must be a passive structural element that must be doing that. And purely from where Titan lies in the sarcomere, I thought Titan might be a really good candidate. And that's when we started doing myofibrillar work. Because in a myofibril, you don't have any collagen that produces passive force. You don't have anything else that produces passive force. There's only Titan. So then we could do these experiments in single sarcomeres and single myofibrils where we could measure what are actually the forces produced by Titan. And then did a variety of different experiments, and we started realizing that when you stretch a muscle actively, the force in a Titan element, in a Titan molecule, becomes much, much bigger than when you activate the muscle just isometrically, or if you stretch it passively. And then we created this theory that maybe Titan would get stiffer by maybe upon activation binding calcium. And then some of the molecular knots that unfold, that we know that unfold in the PVK region, in the immunoglobulin domain region, maybe they would become tighter and Titan would become stiffer. But to make a long story short, that really didn't work. I mean, it worked. Calcium is bound by Titan in certain elements, but it doesn't really have a net effect, a big net effect on stiffness. And then we figured, well, maybe Titan might be binding to actin in its proximal area. And so the spring would not be this long, but it was also being half as long or a quarter as long.
Okay.
And therefore, you know, if you then stretch a short spring, the same absolute amount compared to a long one, then of course it would exert much more force. And the reason why I thought this might be happening was because we know that Titan naturally binds to actin at the very, very end before actin goes into the Z line. We know about 50 nanometers away, Titan rigidly attaches to actin. So we know it does it, except not, you know, it doesn't change it. And then the other thing we knew is that in some precursors, evolutionary precursors of Titan, for example, in mollusk muscles, there's a Titan analog, an evolutionary precursor of Titan that's called twitchin. And we know twitchin can attach between actin and myosin. It can attach and release and attach and release. And it's regulated by phosphorylation. And so we thought, well, there's a precursor of Titan, an evolutionary precursor that does that. We know that Titan binds to actin naturally, its skeletal muscle, except very, very far down, very close to the Z line, which is not useful for our purposes. So we figured, well, maybe there might be attachment sites that when you activate a muscle, stretch it, let cross bridges attach, maybe Titan might be attaching. And then, of course, for the first 10 years, it was virtually impossible to publish that stuff. Because you know, a lot of people just thought, oh, this is nonsense. We know that the history dependence has all to do with sarcomere length non-uniformity. And then we dispelled that. And then in the last 10 years, you know, and then from 2010 to 2020, then people started doing experiments and started thinking, oh, maybe there's something there. And now in the last 5 years, it's almost become accepted that, oh yeah, we know when you activate a muscle and you stretch it, Titan will be attaching to actin, will make itself shorter, it becomes stiffer, and therefore carry much, much more force than if you stretch it passively. And so, interestingly enough, now it's by some groups, it's almost accepted that that's what's happening. And interestingly, me, you know, kind of who proposed that initially like 25 years ago, I'm going, well, but I want to see it. And I still have not seen it. So we did a lot of antibody fluorescent labeling to see movement of Titan relative to actin and all that type of stuff. And now we are working on a very, very new thing that I think might give us the answer. That is, we are going to combine our single sarcomere, single myofibril work with cryo-ET, high-resolution cryo-electron tomography.
Wow.
That has a resolution in the single angstrom level, so we can see atoms. And so we want to capture now Titan under different contractile states and see if Titan indeed, when you are in the force-enhanced state, moves towards actin and binds to Titan. So that's going to keep me busy the next 10 years or so.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, that is, I wondered how you were making these measurements, but that explains it. So, wow, that's pretty awesome stuff. And, you know, I'll just put a plug in. There was a paper that really helped me to visually see what was going on. It was a paper published in 2024, and it was, I forget the exact title, but it was something like a 2D model of the sarcomere. And in that, there's a video, and you can see somebody is just literally taking the sarcomere and pulling it apart, and you can see how the Titan plays into both the actin and the myosin. It was a beautiful model. So thanks for that. That really helped.
Is it a physical model?
The physical model. Yeah. I showed that in class.
I think that was Aaron Medeiros.
That sounds right.
Because he published, he published that, he built that model that physical model and then published it in an educational physiology journal. And that helped you a lot. I'm going to tell him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Please do. Yeah. I showed it in my class.
Oh, yeah. Fabulous.
So wrapping up here, I like to ask this of all my guests. The podcast is, I'm trying to get people interested in pursuing science, chiropractic science, if I can be so biased to say that, but to pursue, research careers, just generally think more about science and how to apply it to chiropractic. So if you could offer any advice to people who may be thinking about pursuing a research career, what broad advice might you give them to consider going into it and what they might think about as they're going through the process?
Yeah, well, I want to start at the end and say it's a beautiful career because, especially if you're an academic researcher like I am, you have essentially complete freedom. And, how do you go about? I think the big thing is always that when you want to go into research, do something that is personally of interest to you. I think that's always more important, So I was interested in muscles from athletes, high performance, world-class athletes. And then, I'm doing completely different things now, but I'm still trying to figure out muscles. And so I think do something that really excites you and motivates you. And then the big thing in science is to ask, good questions and see where the gaps are and what might be important to know. And then in today's science, when I started out, much of it was done by myself, but in today's science, it's so multidisciplinary. Make sure that you might have a couple of colleagues that really extend your knowledge, like I'm coming more from the mechanical side, from the engineering side. And so I'm always working together with with a biologist, a molecular biologist. And right now I'm working with people that know a lot about, electron, high resolution electron microscopy, You don't need to learn everything, but working with the right people is also important. And then I think the other thing is also that you need to love it a little bit, you need to because in science, when you write a paper, when you write a grant, 98 out of 100 times people will critique what you say or what you have written. And maybe 2 out of 100 times you'll say, oh, really well done, Walter. Yeah. But that happens very rarely. So I think one needs to have a little bit of a thick skin and also not take things personally. And I think the big thing is also to be always respectful, independent of what people might say about your work, and even if they are very harsh on your work. I think staying respectful goes a long way. And also being, over the years now, with having a team, I also found that being generous goes a long way, giving responsibility to trainees, to students, to postdocs. Let them write the papers rather than me. They are first author. They do it, They get all the credit, and that is a very motivating factor, later on in your career when you have a little group and students and so on. And I think that's very, very important to make sure that you let, the young people, the new people, the students, the trainees be in the limelight, and you step back. Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate that response. And I have to say that when I posted that we were going to talk on this interview on social media, that was the overwhelming response. Anybody that had any, connection to you, like who did a PhD under you or master's, any work, they all said how kind and generous you were. And so I very much appreciate your generosity coming on the podcast, answering my questions. It was just beautiful. So Dr. Herzog, it's been a real pleasure for me to interview you. And any last thoughts before I let you go?
No, except that the pleasure is all mine. It was a lot of fun, and I really appreciated, you know, I read beforehand briefly. I didn't really prepare for the interview, but I quickly skimmed through your questions, and I was very, very impressed how careful you prepared, obviously, this interview, and how much you knew about the work that you have done. And so I appreciate that very much, that you obviously put in a lot of work as well. In asking interesting questions and making this a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. The pleasure is all mine, Dr. Herzog, and thank you so much. I know that chiropractors, especially, and I think many, many other health professionals and researchers, hopefully will find a lot of interesting tidbits like I have during this interview. So thank you so much.
Great. Thank you very much.